Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, Libya, and others. They are making common cause with criminal elements, Iraqi insurgents, and remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime who want to restore the old order. They fight because they know that the survival of their hateful ideology is at stake. They know that as freedom takes root in Iraq, it will inspire millions across the Middle East to claim their liberty as well. And when the Middle East grows in democracy and prosperity and hope, the terrorists will lose their sponsors, lose their recruits, and lose their hopes for turning that region into a base for attacks on America and our allies around the world. Some wonder whether Iraq is a central front in the war on terror. Among the terrorists, there is no debate. Hear the words of Osama bin Laden. This Third World War is raging in Iraq. The whole world is watching this war. He says it will end in victory and glory, or misery and humiliation. The terrorists know that the outcome will leave them emboldened or defeated. So they're waging a campaign of murder and destruction. And there is no limit to the innocent lives they are willing to take. We see the nature of the enemy in terrorists who exploded car bombs along a busy shopping street in Baghdad, including one outside a mosque. We see the nature of the enemy in terrorists who sent a suicide bomber to a teaching hospital in Mosul. We see the nature of the enemy in terrorists who behead civilian hostages and broadcast their atrocities for the world to see. These are savage acts of violence, but they have not brought the terrorists any closer to achieving their strategic objectives. The terrorists, both foreign and Iraqi, failed to stop the transfer of sovereignty. They failed to break our coalition and force a mass withdrawal by our allies. They failed to incite an Iraqi civil war. They failed to prevent free elections. They failed to stop the formation of a democratic Iraqi government that represents all of Iraq's diverse population. And they failed to stop Iraqis from signing up in large number with the police forces and the army to defend their new democracy. The lesson of this experience is clear. The terrorists can kill the innocent, but they cannot stop the advance of freedom. The only way our enemies can succeed is if we forget the lessons of September the 11th, if we abandon the Iraqi people to men like Zarqawi, and if we yield the future of the Middle East to men like bin Laden. For the sake of our nation's security, this will not happen on my watch. A little over a year ago, I spoke to the nation and described our coalition's goals in Iraq. I said that America's mission in Iraq is to defeat an enemy and give strength to a friend, a free, representative government that is an ally in the war on terror and a beacon of hope in a part of the world that is desperate for reform. I outlined the steps we would take to achieve this goal. We would hand authority over to a sovereign Iraqi government. We would help Iraqis hold free elections by January 2005. We would continue helping Iraqis rebuild their nation's infrastructure and economy. We would encourage more international support for Iraq's democratic transition, and we would enable Iraqis to take increasing responsibility for their own security and stability. In the past year, we have made significant progress. 1 year ago today, we restored sovereignty to the Iraqi people. In January 2005, more than 8 million Iraqi men and women voted in elections that were free and fair, and took place on time. We continued our efforts to help them rebuild their country. Rebuilding a country after 3 decades of tyranny is hard. And rebuilding while at war is even harder. Our progress has been uneven, but progress is being made. We're improving roads and schools, and health clinics. We're working to improve basic services like sanitation, electricity, and water. And together with our allies, we will help the new Iraqi government deliver a better life for its citizens. In the past year, the international community has stepped forward with vital assistance. Some 30 nations have troops in Iraq, and many others are contributing non-military assistance. The United Nations is in Iraq to help Iraqis write a constitution and conduct their next elections. Thus far, some 40 countries and three international organizations have pledged about $34 billion in assistance for Iraqi reconstruction. More than 80 countries and international organizations recently came together in Brussels to coordinate their efforts to help Iraqis provide for their security and rebuild their country. And next month, donor countries will meet in Jordan to support Iraqi reconstruction. Whatever our differences in the past, the world understands that success in Iraq is critical to the security of our nations. As German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said at the White House yesterday, there can be no question a stable and democratic Iraq is in the vested interest of not just Germany, but also Europe. Finally, we have continued our efforts to equip and train Iraqi security forces. We've made gains in both the number and quality of those forces. Today, Iraq has more than 160,000 security forces trained and equipped for a variety of missions. Iraqi forces have fought bravely, helping to capture terrorists and insurgents in Najaf and Samarra, Fallujah and Mosul. And in the past month, Iraqi forces have led a major anti-terrorist campaign in Baghdad called Operation Lightning, which has led to the capture of hundreds of suspected insurgents. Like Free People Everywhere, Iraqis want to be defended by their own countrymen, and we're helping Iraqis assume those duties. The progress in the past year has been significant, and we have a clear path forward. To complete the mission, we will continue to hunt down the terrorists and insurgents. To complete the mission, we will prevent al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorists from turning Iraq into what Afghanistan was under the Taliban, a safe haven from which they could launch attacks on America and our friends. And the best way to complete the mission is to help Iraqis build a free nation that can govern itself, sustain itself, and defend itself. So our strategy going forward has both a military track and a political track. The principal task of our military is to find and defeat the terrorists. And that is why we are on the offense. And as we pursue the terrorists, our military is helping to train Iraqi security forces so that they can defend their people and fight the enemy on their own. Our strategy can be summed up this way: as the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down. We've made progress, but we have a lot more work to do. Today, Iraqi security forces are at different levels of readiness. Some are capable of taking on the terrorists and insurgents by themselves. A large number can plan and execute anti-terrorist operations with coalition support. The rest are forming and not yet ready to participate fully in security operations. Our task is to make the Iraqi units fully capable and independent. We're building up Iraqi security forces as quickly as possible so they can assume the lead in defeating the terrorists and insurgents. Our coalition is devoting considerable resources and manpower to this critical task. Thousands of coalition troops are involved in the training and equipping of Iraqi security forces. NATO is establishing a military academy near Baghdad to train the next generation of Iraqi military leaders. And 17 nations are contributing troops to the NATO training mission. Iraqi army and police are being trained by personnel from Italy, Germany, Ukraine, Turkey, Poland, Romania, Australia, and the United Kingdom. Today, dozens of nations are working toward a common objective, an Iraq that can defend itself, defeat its enemies, and secure its freedom. To further prepare Iraqi forces to fight the enemy on their own, we are taking three new steps. First, we are partnering coalition units with Iraqi units. These coalition Iraqi teams are conducting operations together in the field. These combined operations are giving Iraqis a chance to experience how the most professional armed forces in the world operate in combat. Second, we are embedding coalition transition teams inside Iraqi units. These teams are made up of coalition officers and non-commissioned officers who live, work, and fight together with their Iraqi comrades. Under U.S. command, they are providing battlefield advice and assistance to Iraqi forces during combat operations. Between battles, they are assisting the Iraqis with important skills such as urban combat and intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance techniques. Third, we're working with the Iraqi ministries of Interior and Defense to improve their capabilities to coordinate anti-terrorist operations. We're helping them develop command and control structures. We're also providing them with civilian and military leadership training so Iraq's new leaders can effectively manage their forces in the fight against terror. The new Iraqi security forces are proving their courage every day. More than 2,000 members of Iraqi security forces have given their lives in the line of duty. Thousands more have stepped forward and are now training to serve their nation. With each engagement, Iraqi soldiers grow more battle-hardened, and that would undermine our strategy of encouraging Iraqis to take the lead in this fight. And sending more Americans would suggest that we intend to stay forever, when we are in fact working for the day when Iraq can defend itself and we can leave. As we determine the right force level, our troops can know that I will continue to be guided by the advice that matters, the sober judgment of our military leaders. The other critical element of our strategy is to help ensure that the hopes Iraqis expressed at the polls in January are translated into a secure democracy. The Iraqi people are emerging from decades of tyranny and oppression. Under the regime of Saddam Hussein, the Shia and Kurds were brutally oppressed, and the vast majority of Sunni Arabs were also denied their basic rights, while senior regime officials enjoyed the privileges of unchecked power. The challenge facing Iraqis today is to put this past behind them and come together to build a new Iraq that includes all of its people. They're doing that by building the institutions of a free society, a society based on freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of religion, and equal justice under law. The Iraqis have held free elections and established a transitional national assembly. The next step is to write a good constitution that enshrines these freedoms in permanent law. The assembly plans to expand its constitutional drafting committee to include more Sunni Arabs. Many Sunnis who opposed the January elections are now taking part in the democratic process, and that is essential to Iraq's future. After a constitution is written, the Iraqi people will have a chance to vote on it. If approved, Iraqis will go to the polls again to elect a new government under their new permanent constitution. By taking these critical steps and meeting their deadlines, Iraqis will bind their multi-ethnic society together in a democracy that respects the will of the majority and protects minority rights. As Iraqis grow confident that the democratic progress they're making is real and permanent, more will join the political process. And as Iraqis see that their military can protect them, more will step forward with vital intelligence to help defeat the enemies of a free Iraq. The combination of political and military reform will lay a solid foundation for a free and stable Iraq. As Iraqis make progress toward a free society, the effects are being felt beyond Iraq's borders. Before our coalition liberated Iraq, Libya was secretly pursuing nuclear weapons. Today, the leader of Libya has given up his chemical and nuclear weapons programs. Across the broader Middle East, people are claiming their freedom. In the last few months, we've witnessed elections in the Palestinian territories in Lebanon. These elections are inspiring democratic reformers in places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Our strategy to defend ourselves and spread freedom is working. The rise of freedom in this vital region will eliminate the conditions that feed radicalism and ideologies of murder and make our nation safer. We have more work to do, and there will be tough moments that test America's resolve. We're fighting against men with blind hatred and armed with lethal weapons who are capable of any atrocity. They wear no uniform. They respect no laws of warfare or morality. They take innocent lives to create chaos for the cameras. They are trying to shake our will in Iraq, just as they tried to shake our will on September the 11th, 2001. They will fail. The terrorists do not understand America. The American people do not falter under threat. And we will not allow our future to be determined by car bombers and assassins. America and our friends are in a conflict that demands much of us. It demands the courage of our fighting men and women. It demands the steadfastness of our allies. And it demands the perseverance of our citizens. We accept these burdens because we know what is at stake. We fight today because Iraq now carries the hope of freedom in a vital region of the world. And the rise of democracy will be the ultimate triumph over radicalism and terror. And we fight today because terrorists want to attack our country and kill our citizens, and Iraq is where they are making their stand. So we'll fight them there, we'll fight them across the world, and we will stay in the fight until the fight is won. America has done difficult work before. From our desperate fight for independence to the darkest days of a civil war, to the hard-fought battles against tyranny in the 20th century, there were many chances to lose our heart, our nerve, or our way. But Americans have always held firm because we have always believed in certain truths. We know that if evil is not confronted, it gains in strength and audacity and returns to strike us again. We know that when the work is hard, the proper response is not retreat, it is courage. And we know that this great ideal of human freedom entrusted to us in a special way, and that the ideal of liberty is worth defending. In this time of testing, our troops can know the American people are behind you. Next week, our nation has an opportunity to make sure that support is felt by every soldier, sailor, airman, Coast Guardsman, and Marine at every outpost across the world. This 4th of July, I ask you to find a way to thank the men and women defending our freedom by flying the flag, sending letters to our troops in the field, or helping the military family down the street. The Department of Defense has set up a website, americasupportsyou.mil. You can go there to learn about private efforts in your own community. At this time when we celebrate our freedom, let us stand with the men and women who defend us all. To the soldiers in this hall and our servicemen and women across the globe, I thank you for your courage under fire and your service to our nation. I thank our military families. The burden of war falls especially hard on you. In this war, we have lost good men and women who left our shores to defend freedom and did not live to make the journey home. I've met with families grieving the loss of loved ones who were taken from us too soon. I've been inspired by their strength in the face of such great loss. We pray for the families. And the best way to honor the lives that have been given in this struggle is to complete the mission. I thank those of you who have reenlisted in an hour when your country needs you. And to those watching tonight who are considering a military career, there is no higher calling than service in our armed forces. We live in freedom because every generation has produced patriots willing to serve a cause greater than themselves. Those who serve today are taking their rightful place among the greatest generations that have worn our nation's uniform. When the history of this period is written, the liberation of Afghanistan and the liberation of Iraq will be remembered as great turning points in the story of freedom. After September the 11th, 2001, I told the American people that the road ahead would be difficult and that we would prevail. Well, it has been difficult, and we are prevailing. Our enemies are brutal, but they are no match for the United States of America, and they are no match for the men and women of the United States military. May God bless you all.
You are listening to On Point special coverage of the President's speech at Fort Bragg, North Carolina tonight. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. And we ask, what were you listening for this evening? Did you hear it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I'm joined now from the Capitol by David Ignatius, columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post. David, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Gail.
And also from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, hello.
Hello, Gail. Hello, David.
Gentlemen, before we start parsing some of the specifics of this speech, I wonder if you were struck, as I was, by what was clearly a deliberate choice. I presume to underscore the importance and solemnity of this speech, there was no applause as the president came into the room.
I found the setting somber. It was before a military audience. It was not, in that sense, a political speech. I think wise on the part of the president and his advisors. It had that somber sobriety. And I think if you were a soldier listening to the speech or a member of a soldier's family, you would have heard pretty much the message that you wanted.
And, Jack, did you detect the deft hand of Karl Rove in that decision?
Well, you know, it was more analogous, really, to a president's speech from the Oval Office. I mean, this is so that applause would have been inappropriate.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. David, to you first, what did the president have to do in this speech, and did he accomplish it?
The president, first of all, had to come across as leveling with the American people about this war. Vice President Cheney's last throes comment has become almost laughable to people. They can see on their TV screens each night that this war is very tough. And I think the president, in his very somber tone, did, to me, come across as not sugarcoating this. He talked about how difficult it is. He asked directly the question that every American must be wondering: is the suffering that we're watching worth it? And he tried to explain why it was. I think he had to try to lay out a coherent strategy without sounding phony. I mean, you know, basically the strategy is what it's been for months. He restated it, I think, in very clear terms. The key line was, as the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down. The problem, obviously, is that the process of building Iraqi security forces that can take over from the U.S. is going much slower than people expected. The president conceded that, but he didn't say a whole lot about it. So I thought that that he reiterated the basic themes of his policy well, with good emphasis, as we'll discuss, I'm sure, in a few minutes. There are some weaknesses in that strategy that he didn't address. I'm not sure he can address.
And Jack, the overarching question, first of all, what do you think is going to resonate with the American public?
Well, the president said that the American people do not falter under threat. And then he said, we have, quote, always held firm. Well, you know, historically, that is not true. We did not hold firm in Vietnam. The public forced an end of that war, really an ignominious end. We did not hold firm in Korea. President Truman's approval ratings were in the upper 20s by the time he left office, and he couldn't run for re-election because of Korea. In 1918, the President Wilson's party, just a year and a half into the World War I, was repudiated at the polls, and in the elections of 1920, his war aim, the League of Nations, was repudiated. Even in the Civil War, Lincoln, as late as August 1864, wrote out his resignation to the cabinet because he said, as things look now, I will be defeated in November. And he did look as if he'd be defeated in November, and he was only saved by Sherman's capture of Atlanta. So the point is, the American public has faltered in wars that do not seem to be working, that do not seem to be showing progress, whose ends seem to them confused, even in something like the Civil War, even in something like World War I.
David, you alluded to this a moment ago. Let me pick up on that point. What were you listening for that you didn't hear in this speech?
Well, I think that the fundamental paradox of the situation in Iraq now is that the United States is at once a force for stability and a force for instability. Even as we try to build up these Iraqi security forces, we are being attacked. The rate of suicide bombings and other attacks that hit Iraqis worse than Americans continues. I have to say that, we are now 1 year after the transfer of sovereignty, and I think everybody associated with this policy would have hoped for a more stable and secure Iraq today than what we're seeing. So what I didn't hear was a coherent account of what's gone wrong. I think this president just never feels comfortable looking at mistakes, and he didn't do that tonight. My own feeling is that unless we analyze with more clarity what's gone wrong, we're not going to get this policy right. If we remember Vietnam, the metrics that the military used to assess progress in Vietnam were all pointing up until the very moment that people basically lost heart and began to abandon the war. And I worry that that's the case now. I talk a lot with military commanders there on my visits to Iraq and when they come back to Washington. And, they continually give you this upbeat account that just doesn't square with what we correspondents see on the ground and hear from our own Iraqi contacts. And again, I think the president didn't really square that problem, and it's one that's there. I don't know that he can say a whole lot more than we're trying to build these Iraqi security forces. It's going to take time. Be patient, and we just have to hope that at some point she'll reach a tipping point in our favor, not in favor of the insurgents.
Well, and Jack, do you get the sense that the goalposts are changing here? First there was the declaration of mission accomplished, but the fighting continued. And then it was, a handover of power, and the fighting continued. Then elections, and the fighting continued. And so now, the next marker is a constitution by August. What's the end game here?
Well, that constitution by August, the president didn't allude to August, but he did say that the Iraqis have to keep their timetable, and the timetable called for August. But as was brought out on Morning Edition on NPR this morning, the Iraqis are seriously considering putting that constitution off for another 6 months. They have the authority to do that. However, if for the next month the president is saying we've got to keep our deadline, that everything depends upon showing the Iraqi people that you're making progress, we've got to get that constitution up in August, and the Iraqis say no, we can't do this for another 6 months, then Mr. Bush will have set up a credibility crisis for himself, for his own popularity. which is unnecessary. And I rather hoped tonight that he would inoculate Americans against that and just say, look, it's taking them longer than they thought. They're going to have to extend the time.
We'll continue in just a moment with our On Point special coverage of the president's speech tonight at Fort Bragg. What were you listening for, and did you hear it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is our continuing On Point special coverage of the president's speech at Fort Bragg, North Carolina tonight. We wonder what you were listening for and whether you heard it. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Ignatius is with us from Washington. He's columnist and associate editor for The Washington Post. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And gentlemen, let's go to our phone lines and hear what some of our listeners have to say about the president's speech. First to Queensboro, North Carolina. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark, and welcome.
Thank you very much.
What did you think?
Well, I agree with what the president said. As a nation, we do have to hold steadfast. I know people, you know, I was listening. I know as Americans, we kind of want the quick fix, but I believe we have to stay the course, because if we don't, we'll be going back, you know, for another generation. It's going to just keep on, the cycle's going to keep on going. We got to get the job done now. And don't get me wrong, I am, you know, saddened by when I hear, you know, the death of our soldiers over there trying to defend freedom. But, it's something that has to be paid. But don't let their death be in vain. It's got to be done now and done right.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for the call. I want to bring James Dobbins into the conversation now. He is director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the Rand Corporation, served as special envoy to the Afghanistan opposition for the Bush administration, and is former Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and the principal author of The Rand, History of Nation Building. James Dobbins, welcome to you.
Thank you.
What were you listening for, and did you hear it tonight?
Well, I think that the president gave a speech that was entirely appropriate for the military audience, but it may not have reached out to sufficiently to the American people as a whole. I mean, there's two categories of people who currently support our efforts in Iraq. One are the larger group who think it was a good idea in the first place, continue to think it was a good idea, and continue to support it. But the pivotal group are people who aren't so sure that it was a good idea in the first place, but recognize we're stuck, we've got to see it through, that we can't afford to leave, that the consequences of leaving would be disastrous, and are prepared to be persuaded that we need to stay, even though it wasn't a great idea in the first place. Now, not surprisingly, I think, the president didn't particularly reach out to that second group. But that is the pivotal group. Unless they can be held, we can't maintain a majority for this effort.
I want to go to Dan now, who's on the line from Whitman, Massachusetts. Our first caller said, stay the course. Dan, what do you think? Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Actually, this is Tom from Mansfield, Massachusetts. But what I wanted to say is that I was offended by and the repeated references to September 11th, as if that justifies whatever foreign policy decision we make for the next 100 years. I think the president needs to start coming up with some justifications for his foreign policy decisions that can stand on their own grounds and not simply say whatever I do is a response to this atrocity, and therefore you've got to back me regardless of how ill-founded the policy is. And I think he's using that as a crutch, and I don't think it carries any weight at this point, and I think he really needs to come up with a better explanation and a better policy for what we're doing in Iraq. I didn't hear it tonight.
Tom, thanks for the call. David, what did you think of Tom's point?
I think Tom makes a good point, and it's one we really ought to focus on in the president's speech. The rationale he argued for the Iraq policy in many ways did focus on the 9/11 parallel, fighting the war that began on September 11. And I think that's really the weakest part of the argument that he's making. It's hard looking at Iraq not to think that the terrorism problem that the United States confronts is worse today and will be worse in the future because of the new Center for Terrorism that has been created in this lawless, anarchic post-invasion Iraq. And the president really didn't engage that argument. By the same token, I think the president is right in saying that for Osama bin Laden, for jihadist terrorists in general, they expect that if they hit the United States hard, as they did on September 11 and as they're doing in Iraq, the United States, being essentially a decadent, rich society, will buckle. Osama bin Laden's own writings are full of that theme. And so I think the president is right to say that if we were to pull out, to retreat under fire, that would be a victory for our terrorist enemies.
But of course, it isn't just decadence that makes that kind of thing happen. It's democracy. Publics will not support wars that they don't believe in. They don't support wars that have been sold to them under different pretenses than the ones that are currently being used. And they exercise that with their feet by voting and by polls and by demonstrations. And that isn't decadence. That, in fact, is one of the sources of our strength. It's been one of the sources of our strength throughout our history.
I didn't mean to be agreeing with bin Laden about American decadence, and I think that, in fact, the most recent Washington Post poll shows that the public really is quite steadfast. 1 in 8 polled favored a quick withdrawal, and, you know, people support the war, even though they don't think it's going very well. So that shows a tough-mindedness that I think is appropriate. I'm just saying that in the minds of bin Laden and other adversaries, there is this view of the United States as being weak. Hit them hard and they'll fold.
James Dobbins.
I think we're all saying the same thing, which is that the president didn't really reach out to his critics who are prepared to support the war, but who are looking for a more sophisticated rationale.
Well, and James Dobbins, I want to draw on your experience in Afghanistan a bit here, because we heard the president say tonight that to complete the mission, we will prevent al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorists from turning Iraq into what Afghanistan was under the Taliban, a safe haven from which they could launch attacks on America and our friends. And yet, there was a CIA report just the other day that said, in fact, Iraq is now a training ground for a new generation of terrorists, and that they now get to practice with live targets.
Yeah, it's not yet a safe haven, because we're making it fairly dangerous for them. But there's no doubt that there are more terrorists there than there were before we intervened, that the problem has become much more severe. I think what the president focused naturally enough on is the military dimension of this problem. He focused a bit on the political dimension, and he didn't really focus at all on the diplomatic dimension, on the relationship with the neighboring states, who are in one way or another either feeding the problem or potentially contributing to its solution. And I think what's missing from both the president's speech and from our strategy, frankly, is a regional approach that is going to draw neighboring states into solving this problem in the way that we did in Afghanistan and did in the Balkans in the mid-90s.
Well, and also I wonder, as I'm looking here at another quote from the speech about how, as Iraqis grow confident that the democratic progress they're making is real, more will join the political process, more will step forward with vital intelligence, they will have a solid foundation for a free and stable Iraq. I don't want to be too cynical here, but isn't this the same kind of rosy scenario we've heard before about how, you know, when American troops march into Baghdad, they will be met with chocolate and flowers? David?
Yeah, I mean, if
or James?
I mean, I think that eventually there's a possibility that these rosy predictions will come true, but there's no doubt that that the administration has been guilty of over-optimism. Now, the president was more restrained in this occasion. He certainly didn't talk about the insurgency being in its death throes. And I do think that the process of training up more effective Iraqi security units, military and police, is in fact beginning to make some progress. But it is the political and diplomatic aspects of this campaign that are the more problematic at this stage, frankly.
Yes, and look at the political situation within Iraq. According to a poll conducted for the coalition authorities, 45% of Iraqis support the insurgency at one level or another. Now, you talk about hearts and minds. This says basically half that population supports the enemy. We aren't succeeding there. And, of course, the problem always is that we are blamed for everything that goes wrong, for every time the tap doesn't go on, the electricity doesn't work, and the car bombs. You know, eventually, of course, it's the terrorists, but eventually people keep thinking, well, why can't you protect us? There have been 500 car bombs since a year ago, 8,000 Iraqis dead, 890 U.S. soldiers dead, attacks are up from 52 to 70 a month that last month. Of course, in our recruiting problems, we know, and terrorist attacks around the world in the year before, up. So the president says significant progress has been made, but it's very hard, just looking at the even barest outlines of the statistics, to make that case.
And David Ignatius, what light can you shed on what the leaders of these insurgents want and whether they're likely to get it?
Well, I think that the Sunnis, after the January 30 elections, which they chose to boycott, I think they thought they could force the U.S. to cancel or postpone the elections, and were surprised when that didn't happen. I think afterwards there was a period of regret. They began to talk publicly about trying to join the political process in some way. They saw that, you know, this new political structure in Iraq was moving forward. There was a very long delay in forming the government. A lot of that progress momentum was lost, I think. And the new government, it must be said, is not very effective in reaching out to people who feel outside of the process. They grudgingly have added some additional Sunni Arabs to the Constitutional Committee. That's long overdue. But there is a strong sectarian character to this government. You know, these are the people who were dispossessed, left out of the system by the Sunni-led government of Saddam Hussein. And there is a kind of payback dimension going on. As long as that continues, we're going to be in trouble. Somehow we have to help Iraqis get past that. And, you know, again, I think if you were having a serious talk about the details of strategy and not the broad strokes the president laid out, that would be item number one.
To our phone lines again, to Concord, Massachusetts. Mary's on the line. Hello, Mary, and welcome.
Thank you very much. I heard nothing new tonight. It was the same rhetoric about we're fighting for freedom and democracy, and this is all worth it because we're fighting for freedom and democracy. He said there was progress with the coalition. I don't see any progress with any countries that can make a difference there getting more involved. I don't see the world community getting more involved. Maybe there's a plan. I guess the plan is to eventually transition this over to the Iraqis, but there's no goals. I was looking for a plan. I was looking for some goals so that we know there's some end in sight somewhere other than this elusive freedom and democracy, whatever that is and whenever it happens. So I was very frustrated and very disappointed, as I have been throughout the entire war. But I was hoping that maybe there would finally be some kind of plan or some kind of goals that we could attach onto and something tangible, other than this continued ideology.
Mary, thanks for the call. James Dobbins, to you, when the president said, laid out his reasons for not setting a deadline, serious mistake, wrong message to the Iraqis, to our troops, to the enemy, was that a good enough argument?
I do think that setting a deadline would be a mistake. I think that setting a deadline would simply embolden the extremists. It would give them a date by which they could, if they simply held out to that date, they would know that they could prevail. It would diminish any sense that people on the fence have, that it's time to get off the fence and get on the Democratic bandwagon. So I do think that's a mistake. I do think the president came close to doing what I would have liked him to do, which is to state unequivocally that our intention is ultimately, once the Iraqi government is able to protect its citizens and defend its country, to leave completely, that we will retain no bases, no personnel whatsoever. I think an unequivocal statement like that would diminish a lot of the skepticism in Iraq about our real motivations.
Jeremy, I want to go to you on our phone lines from Quincy, Massachusetts, but I have to ask you to be really brief, if you will.
Okay, very quickly. Bush made a comment about if we need more troops in Iraq, we're willing to send them, but right now it's okay. But with the stop-loss policy, recruitment levels dropping, how does he intend to supply these troops?
All right, Jeremy, thanks for the point.
Yes, they're giving now bonuses of $20,000 to enlist in the Army, and for as short a period as 15 months, and their recruitment is still down by 25%.
Well,
if I can just go to the point that Mr. Dobb has made, the idea of the deadline. The other way to look at it, of course, is that the Iraqi people we're training don't have an incentive to go to fight the enemy if we're telling them every day, and as our defense secretary told them on Sunday, that we're going to be there 5, 6, 10, 12 years. You don't have to fight. We're going to be around to do it for you. Ed Luttwak, who's mamby-pamby, long ago wrote about this. He said, listen, we need to send them a signal that it's their country. They're going to fight.
If I could just offer one thought from the speech, I think the president was most specific in talking about our efforts to partner with Iraqi troops in the field and to embed little advisor teams with Iraqi units. And I think that everybody associated with this policy, certainly on the military side, would like to see us get out of the business of trying to maintain order in Iraqi cities and the countryside, and in the business of training and advising. And if the president is to be taken at his word in what he said tonight, we are going to move more toward that kind of posture, and that's probably something that will make the war easier to swallow for Americans.
Have to leave it there for now. Thank you all so much. David Ignatius, associate editor, columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
To James Dobbins, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, as always, a pleasure to have you with us. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
We have been, you've been listening to our On Point special coverage of the president's speech at Fort Bragg, North Carolina tonight. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.